From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit us at stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
Since the outbreak of the war, more than 100,000 people have been killed. More than 2 million people have become refugees, and millions more displaced within the war-torn country. And now Syrians are the most displaced people on earth.
As he was preparing for Yom Kippur this year, Rabbi Shmuley Yanklowitz was moved to write a meditation on the Jewish season and on the ongoing bloodshed in Syria. His deeply moving words, published in the Washington Post On Faith section, make clear the connection, and he'll share his thoughts with us on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Science and religion headed for a collision once again.
What should your child be taught? Evolution? Creation? Both or something else altogether?
I do think that there's a creator. I'm a Christian.
You can choose to believe that theory. It's a theory.
I'd certainly want my kids to be exposed to the very best science.
Federal law simply says that it is illegal to require the teaching of creationism. We're talking about adding it to the textbook or adding it as a supplement.
As millions of American kids headed back to school this year, many of them unknowingly walked into classrooms that are in the crosshairs of the culture wars. As challenges to science education abound from creationists, climate change skeptics, and I'm sure if you looked hard enough, flat earth advocates, the National Center for Science Education has launched the Science League of America website, designed to carry forward the dream of honest and thorough science education. I'll be talking with Josh Rusinow, the center's programs and policy director. And then there's this.
I look at the story of David and Goliath. Mm-hmm. All David needed was one smooth stone.
Who do you suppose Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann thinks is Goliath in today's American politics? Well, I'm going to let you know at the end of today's show, so stay tuned. But first,
conversations about religion at work, we've got to be very careful about.
If you are a faithful churchgoer, what would make you miss Sunday service? Perhaps your full-time job?
I don't know how Muslims handle it in the workplace, but do they stop down five times a day and stop working and go and pray?
There is a remarkable new survey from the Tannenbaum Center and the Public Religion Research Institute that contains a wealth of information about how American workers experience religious accommodation on the job and how that experience informs everything from job satisfaction to individual career plans. The survey is entitled The 2013 Survey of American Workers and Religion, and I am very happy to be joined by the Tannenbaum Center's CEO, Joyce Dubinsky, for a look at some of the highlights. Joyce, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It's a privilege to be with you. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to just start by giving our listeners an idea of the levels of social diversity that are found in today's workplace.
The findings were quite striking. We had developed a measure for assessing how diverse workplaces were by the frequency of contact that people had with colleagues who were different from them in one way or another, both religiously, sometimes racially, ethnically, as well as colleagues with different sexual orientations. And what we found was that nearly one in two American workers today is working in a workplace that is quite diverse and where there is an escalating amount of conflict involving religion.
The people in the survey could either say they had experienced non-accommodation or they had observed non-accommodation. You gave one example there of the Sabbath, but it might be helpful to talk a little bit more about what non-accommodation means for our listeners.
Well, we had actually identified 9 different measures, and we asked about each of them. These included whether they were discouraged from wearing facial hair or certain types of dress that were religiously important for their identity, whether they had time to pray or meditate or reflect if they needed to during the workday, whether when they went to a workplace event, they could find what they needed to eat, you know, because some people need kosher food, some people need food that is halal or vegetarian. We asked whether they were discouraged from displaying objects that might be deemed religious or symbols or quotations in their personal workspace. Whether when they went to a company meeting, it was opened with a prayer. We asked about something that I describe as ridicule, but the specific questions involved whether there were jokes about one's religious beliefs, practices, or clothing. And again, about Sabbath observances and religious holidays and the ability to observe them or whether they had to work. And whether they were ever discouraged from creating a professional religious group at work. You know, there are many employee resource groups in many companies. And whether or not there could be one around a religious tradition and whether they had sought that and been denied. And whether they were ever criticized, ever had a conflict around a social issue involving, for religious reasons, not participating, say, in a celebration that was against their belief in some way and found themselves being joked about or criticized for not having participated. So it was very specific.
Yeah, that's great. How did the numbers look in that part of the survey?
Well, what we found was that when we asked broadly, and I think this is alarming, 1 in 3 American workers will tell you, actually more than 1 in 3 will tell you, that they have personally experienced or actually seen a colleague suffering one or more of these forms of non-accommodation. So that's a large number, but within that number, there are 3 groups that stand out in particular. And they had higher percentages of non-accommodation. And that would be the members of minority religious traditions in our country, the group that is sometimes called the nuns or the not religiously affiliated, atheists, agnostics, people who are spiritual and define themselves as secular. But also the white evangelical Christian community stood out as feeling really targeted based on their beliefs.
How about the atheists? Was that a high level of non-accommodation?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, about 40% reported that they'd experienced or actually seen it occurring for them.
I also want to ask about what you described as a unique footprint for white evangelical Christians. It's very difficult not to believe that they share their faith in the workplace, but to think that they are being discriminated against in the workplace. Can you explain that a little more?
I think what the survey shows is how they feel their experience is in the workplace and what they feel that they are experiencing. And so the white evangelical Christians stood out even among the Christian community broadly. And 40% of them said that they, as a community, were experiencing as much bias as any other group in our society that's being marginalized. So they were twice as likely to believe that Christians were suffering from discrimination as they were to believe that African Americans were suffering from discrimination.
I would assume that a white evangelical Christian who tried to share their testimony in the workplace might have encountered people who said, I don't want to hear that. And then is that what they would consider not being respected?
The survey doesn't get to that particular question.
Uh-huh.
I think what's important is that people experience the same comment differently. So where one person might experience a colleague simply sharing information, that same information might be experienced and described by another colleague as proselytizing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a complex and nuanced issue. It is something that requires a lot of attention and understanding not only of groups, but also of the individuals within each group who experience their faith in a particular way. But the survey does suggest that there is a phenomenon of asymmetrical sharing,
mm-hmm.
meaning that there are some groups, including atheists and those who would be considered in the minority religious traditions in this country,
mm-hmm.
and they report sharing about their own beliefs far less than they report hearing about beliefs from others.
I see. Joyce, what trends did you see in this research?
The key trend, and I think the key takeaway for me, was that religion is in the workplace, it's an issue in the workplace, and it's something that the best companies need to learn to manage so that they can be more successful. We believe that we are going to be seeing hotspots, if you will, areas of conflict, in particular between white evangelical Christians and atheists, and members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community and Christians.
Mm-hmm.
In the largest of companies, which are the most diverse and often the most successful, what we are finding is that 1 in 4 workers report experiencing or seeing a conflict between a member of the LGBT community and the Christian community.
Hmm.
And that's already happening.
Yeah.
Another thing that we have seen in terms of a trend is that companies that are addressing these issues proactively are actually having happier employees, and they're becoming magnets for talent, a key determinant in which companies are going to increase their market share.
I've got to ask, what was most surprising to you?
Well, I expected that we would see issues around people from minority religions and atheists, agnostics, and secular people.
Mm-hmm.
What I was shocked about, there were a couple of things. One was that more than a majority of American workers actually believe that Muslims are suffering from discrimination in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to believe that is a real phenomenon that's happening for many Muslims, and I was surprised by the number that saw that as well.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, I was surprised by how marginalized and targeted the white evangelical Christian community feels, and I think that that is an issue that needs to be addressed. And we need to understand that while most of our discussions throughout our history in diversity have been around minority groups or those without power and as much opportunity as others, we are now, when we talk about religion, not only talking about minorities, but we are also talking about members of the majority community also being targeted and feeling marginalized, mm-hmm. and all have to be addressed.
Joyce Dubinsky is CEO of the Tannenbaum Center in New York. The Tannenbaum Center, together with the Public Religion Research Institute, has produced a fascinating new report titled The 2013 Survey of American Workers and Religion. It is available for a limited time as a free download at www.tannenbaum.org. Joyce, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today, enlightening us, and also just thanks for what you do every single day.
Thank you so much, Will.
Later, Defending Education from the War on Science, with the National Center for Science Education's Josh Rosenau. Rabbi Shmuley Yanklowitz is the executive director of Valley Beit Midrash in Phoenix, Arizona. This year, as he prepared for Yom Kippur, and let me make clear that we're doing this interview before Yom Kippur, Rabbi Shmuley wrote a meditation on the tragic human situation in Syria. Rabbi Shmuley, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much.
What moved you to write this article?
I really struggled in my prayer on Rosh Hashanah when I was leading a congregation to really pray, feeling that such a state of distress on what's happening in the world with over 100,000 killed, I mean, just millions displaced, something that really touched my soul in the deepest way, just thinking of the men, women, and children who are struggling so deeply. You know, the death toll in Syria now is higher than the Bosnian genocide. Mm-hmm. And the world continues to stand by. And so I really feel as I'm approaching Yom Kippur, the most solemn and intense day in the Jewish calendar, I can't and really won't let myself get this off my mind that this is what religion is about for me. It's about opening our hearts and souls to feel the pain of other people.
I know what you wrote says that you are very sensitive to the connection between what's happening in Syria and Yom Kippur.
You know, I think there's two connections for me. One is that it's a day on the Jewish calendar where we really atone for our wrongdoings in the past year. But it's not only our wrongdoings, it's our missed potential. And I feel that as human beings, especially as Americans, we have so much potential to create social change in the world. And I really hold myself accountable for not doing enough on such a crucial issue. You know, since 2011, the Syrians have been pleading for help from the world. If you look on YouTube, you'll see these protests calling for no-fly zones and everything else. So on the one hand, I feel like I really have to beat my chest, having not done enough in the world for this. The second bit is that the one of the most powerful prayers in the liturgy of Yom Kippur is called Unatana Tokef, where we humbly submit that we don't know who will live and die in the coming year and pray for life. And it really, that same prayer struck me on Rosh Hashanah, the sense that while I'm sitting in, you know, a comfortable synagogue praying, there's people fleeing for their lives. And so the intensity of the day and holding myself accountable for not meeting my potential really has awoken me to feel very in touch with what's happening over on the other side of the world.
I often speak of prayer, think of prayer as being a means of addressing a situation, the outcome of which is for us to try to be answers to our own prayers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's really well said. One of the quotes I shared in the Washington Post On Faith article you mentioned was, sometimes I want to ask God why God allows poverty, famine, and injustice in the world when he could do something about it, but I'm afraid he might just ask me the same question, holding ourselves accountable.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. I don't want to just preach from on high and, you know, pray as magic. I really want to live my life as best as I can, and every Yom Kippur I realize how much I've failed at doing this, but try to live as a model for giving my best to address the suffering of the vulnerable in the world. And I really feel so intensely this year that we can't be stuck in moral ambiguity. These issues are so complicated, you know, foreign policy and military intervention, this and that. But there's so many positive ways to make change, whether it's addressing humanitarian needs, whether it's helping to shift the discourse, whether it's through advocacy. And I really feel that we can't just sit back and complain and preach and this and that, but get out there and do it. And, you know, as humans, we're so infused with self-interest, you know, the sense of praying for my life, which, you know, I and Jews around the world are going to do this Friday night and Saturday. You know, there's a Jewish teaching that God only hears the prayers of those who pray for others. Mm-hmm. And I would just sort of add to that, that those who act for others.
As a young person, my parents insisted that each of us say our prayers at night. And I can remember getting into the habit of lying down and saying, God, you know what all the problems are. Please do something about them. Mm. And you gave what I think is one of the best answers to knowing how a prayer is answered. You don't say that peace will come for you praying about peace. You say you'll know that your prayers are answered if you are led to stronger and more effective action.
It's a really challenging issue for me, and I have felt for a while that the good obviously suffer, and a lot of the evil, so to speak, prosper, and it's inexplicable. And I've come to realize that in order to actualize free will in the world, for humans to really make moral choices, God has to humbly remove God's self from the world, and we can no longer live with, I don't mean to put it down, but what I have viewed as sort of an infant theology, that as infants we think our parents will take care of everything and God will take care of everything. And in this world it simply doesn't work this way. God has entrusted us to handle this world and to take responsibility. And God, I believe, in a sort of a liberation theology kind of way, is sort of crying and cheering from the sidelines. And maybe at times intervening to support, but in ways that I certainly will never understand. And this has really helped me to take more responsibility rather than let me off the hook. You know, the great philosopher David Hume once wrote that we humans are more concerned with the stubbing of their own toe than they are with a death on the other side of the world. And this is one of the tragedies of the human condition, that we are so infused with self-concern. And that's part of the way we're wired. We don't have to feel tremendous guilt about that. But I do think that prayer is trying to get us to expand our realm of concern, our sense of empathy for others that we don't even know. Look, I mean, everyone knows that there's a conflict between the West and radical Islam right now, and the Jewish community has particularly been vulnerable to this. But I feel like I'm not praying for or acting for, you know, a group that we're in conflict with. I'm praying for humans, and I'm acting for humans. And I think we have to remove those boundaries, and that's part of what prayer does also, is reminds us of our core humanity, that we're not members of one faith. We're just humans standing humbly before an amazing God.
Rabbi Yankelevitz, what else should we be thinking about with the High Holy Days just passed and the Jewish New Year unfolding?
You know, I think the main thing we can all be thinking about is, where is my unique power? I really think in the 21st century, we feel very powerless to create change. And I think that all of us are in positions and in relationships and in locations where we have access to create some kind of change, whether it's for a custodian who is underpaid, whether it's for a domestic worker who is mistreated, whether it's for advocacy on an international issue. I feel that we all have access to do something for other people in a systemic, sustainable way. And the question is, how can I actualize my potential to use whatever access I have, whatever power I have in society, to help other vulnerable people? And I pray and I hope that this coming year will be better for all of us, especially the most vulnerable in the world.
Rabbi Shmuley Yankelevitz is a modern Orthodox rabbi. He's an activist, educator, and author as well. He's the executive director of Valley Beit Midrash in Phoenix, Arizona. You can read his Yom Kippur thoughts on the tragedy of Syria in the Washington Post's On Faith section. And I really do thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Last month, the National Center for Science Education launched an internet resource aimed at what many see as an outright assault on science education in this country. The Science League of America website is designed to, quote, carry forward the dream of honest and thorough science education, in the words of the center's programs and policy director, Josh Rosenau, who joins me now on State of Belief Radio. Josh, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the National Center for Science Education.
The National Center for Science Education is a nonprofit. We're based out in California, but we work all over the country and really all over the world, wherever there are attacks on evolution education, attacks on climate change education, attacks on science education in general.
You talk about, quote, defending the teaching of evolution and climate science. Who is attacking that?
It varies. You know, we get calls from parents who are wondering why their kids are coming home with quizzes that, that act as if evolution was wrong, as if the world was created in 6 days, 6,000 years ago. We get calls from teachers who are getting pressure from principals, telling them not to teach about climate change or to teach that climate change isn't happening. Next week, I'm going to be in Texas talking to the State Board of Education there to make sure that they adopt textbooks that accurately reflect the state of the science on evolution and climate change. So it varies from all those levels.
Yeah.
You know, underlying it, in both cases, there's a political or religious or sort of cultural agenda beyond the science that people are trying to impose.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of evolution, it's a religious agenda, a perception, which, as you and your listeners know, a misguided perception that there's an inherent conflict between evolution and their religious views.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of climate change, it's often a perception of the political issue that the science is being presented simply as a way to get to a political or economic consequence.
You know, Josh, I know the evangelical community well, and by the way, be on your toes when you go to Texas before the Board of Education.
Oh, I know. I've done this before.
I bet you have. But taking evolution out of it for a moment, I understand the evolution debate because of literalistic interpretations of Genesis and so forth, but I don't understand the protest against climate science and climate change. You said there's a political suspicion, political goal that people think. What is it they're scared of?
There's a book by Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway called The Merchants of Doubt, where there are two historians of science who track through the rise of the climate change denial movement and other similar movements. A lot of the same players who were originally hired by the tobacco industry to defend them against charges that they were causing cancer, which were, to create doubt around that. There's a famous tobacco industry memo where one of them says, our product is doubt. It's not that we have to prove that tobacco doesn't cause cancer. We just have to leave enough doubt out there that people can justify smoking and can avoid regulation. You know, there's too much doubt to do regulation. Uh-huh. And it's a lot of that same rhetoric shows up around climate change.
Absolutely.
And through the 80s and 90s, it was a lot of the same people making those arguments, you know, the same people using the same playbook. They attribute this shared purpose across those industries to what they call free market fundamentalism.
Uh-huh.
So this belief that the market should be allowed to do whatever it will without government regulation, without government involvement, and a perception that, probably not an unreasonable perception, that if we take climate change seriously, if we think climate change is happening, and we think that everything that we understand will happen as a result is not good, which
mm-hmm.
most people do,
right,
that it's not something that the free market can solve on its own. It's something that the government, that there will have to be regulation. There will have to be some sort of intervention in the marketplace. And this becomes then the end of American freedom in the rhetoric, which is as unjustified as the idea that teaching evolution is the end of Christianity.
Right, yeah. For you, what was the tipping point? What made you think, okay, it's time for us to get in place a resource like the Science League of America website?
I'd read a biography of Maynard Shipley, who founded the original Science League back in the 20s, and I thought he was kind of cool. And I love that name. It's an homage to this group that Shipley founded in the 20s.
Uh-huh.
That did something very similar to what NCSE does today. So it's a way of connecting back to those roots.
Good.
And a reminder that this is not a fight that goes away easily. When NCSE was founded in the 80s, we chose a rather optimistic name, you know, the National Center for Science Education, given that really we're working on evolution at the time. And the hope, I think, that the board had at the time was, you know, choose this really big name, and we'll deal with this creationism issue, and then we can move on to other science education problems. And we're still fighting creationism. It's been an issue in American education for the last 80 or 90 years,
mm-hmm.
and it shows no signs of going away. It's really deeply integrated into the American political landscape.
Tell us again the website.
The Science League of America is at ncse.com/blog, NCSE, National Center for Science Education. And that's really the place for the staff, the folks behind the scenes here, to be able to show a little bit of what we're thinking about and what we're talking about. You know, on the front page of the website, if you just go to ncse.com, you'll get a summary of news and events that are happening around the issues that we're tracking, but very neutral voice. The blog is a place where you see what's going on inside our heads as we're thinking about the day's news.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a chance to, we've got a comment section, people can weigh in, and it's a chance for us to hear from the folks on whose behalf we're doing this work.
Yeah. Jack Rosenau is policy director at the National Center for Science Education. The center's just launched a new internet resource, the Science League of America website. You can find it at www.ncse.com/blog. Josh, you're doing important work. Thanks for taking time to tell us about it and be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Now, before we go, you may have heard or read about the latest nugget of religio-political wisdom from Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann.
Are you one of those who just assumes that Secretary Hillary Clinton will be coronated?
I don't at all, because I look at the story of David and Goliath. Mm-hmm. All David needed was one smooth stone to fell the giant. It wasn't the stone. It wasn't David. It was the strong right arm of a holy God. And again, I believe that it's in some ways up to us. If we repent, if we cry mm-hmm. out to God, we have no idea what the Lord God will do for us in 2016.
Now, you may dismiss this as an extremist politician saying extremist things, and you'd be exactly right. But there is more to it than that. This little clip, as posted by the People for the American Way website, Right Wing Watch, is from an interview which claims to air on 650 stations nationwide. You can bet that most listeners probably nodded their heads as Ms. Bachmann spoke, in quite agreement with her. It would surprise no one to hear that Representative Bachmann has significant differences of opinion with Secretary Clinton on most issues. And in a pluralistic society, that's exactly how it should be. But it's a great leap from differences of opinion to the vilification of one's opponents, particularly vilification in the language of faith. Representative Bachmann continues to be a leading voice in blaming America's alleged decline on a lack of Christian piety, as she defines it, and always, always entangling that with completely misguided anti-Muslim rhetoric. In this same interview, Bachmann reiterated things we've heard her say before. God told her to run for Congress. God told her to run for the White House. And now God has told her not to run for re-election. Thank God. In 2012, Michelle Bachmann was not the only presidential candidate to credit a higher power with encouraging his or her candidacy. And with the 2016 election still so far away, it's really not encouraging to hear biblical language already being invoked in the service of electoral politics. Frankly, this does a grave disservice to the listeners of those 650 radio stations as they strive to participate as members of a well-informed electorate. It does an equally grave disservice to them as people of faith. God is not choosing the next president of the United States any more than God chose the one in office now. Democracy does that, and a democratic vote. Perhaps it's inevitable that this obscene blurring of the line between politics and religion will just go on and on and on. But how much more useful would it be if the Old Testament figure of Goliath were used to represent the heartbreaking level of violence in Syria and elsewhere in our world? How about poverty? Or the other seemingly overwhelming problems that seem so abundant today? Wouldn't it serve both faith and the faithful so much better to recognize the biblical scale of human suffering? and leave individual candidates, be they Michelle Bachmann or Hillary Clinton, as human beings doing their individual best to address that suffering, even if their opinions on how to achieve that are diametrically opposed? If, in fact, God does make a practice of speaking to Michelle Bachmann, I do wish God would make that suggestion to her one of these days. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution to us today. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. The listener line is 800-856-0277. We've got a really important show planned for next week, and I want to encourage you to send in your questions. We're going to be discussing the future of progressive religion and its role in our society with Auburn Theological Seminary President Catherine Henderson. And after attempts to brand July as ex-gay Pride Month culminated in a rally that drew all of 10 people to the nation's capital, fresh attempts to make September ex-gay awareness month show the relentlessness of this small but destructive movement. You'll hear from a survivor of so-called reparative therapy who has spearheaded a project gathering data on the experiences of fellow survivors. And you'll meet a mother who suffered the ultimate loss, the death of a son, and today is an activist helping other Christian parents reconcile their faith with loving their LGBT children. 800-856-0277. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.